So good evening, everyone. My name is Jacob. I use he, him pronouns. I'm looking for a place to put this recorder presently. I've been a student of Buddhism and not a teacher for about 20 years, if you count generously. Outside the Zendo, I'm a registered clinical counselor. I presently work with Fraser Health, trying to support with communication and program development within the healthcare system. This is my third annual summer Help Kate and Michael Get Some Time Off Dharma Talk. Part of me appreciates these talks as an opportunity to recognize how much work Kate and Michael do for our community. I don't like public speaking, so even imagining doing this twice a year seems like a lot. They prep dozens of these talks while sitting on board meetings and doing Dokusan and structuring the Zendo and quarterbacking our cooking and writing newsletters, so I mean it when I say that you're heroes to me, and I'm really grateful to be studying with you. I'm also just want to say thank you for the sort of spirit of potluck communitarianism our community has. I really appreciate that this is something that, as a young person, I wanted something like this community. I didn't have something like this community, and I, at points, despaired for the sense that I would never find this kind of community. So, to me, this is a really precious and truly like a sacred space. So, I hope that I can offer some words that may be of value. I'll never be able to offer cooking of value, but maybe words. And, you know, if I put you to sleep with these words, I hope you have a pleasant nap. Please don't struggle too much with not falling over. Just go with it if you have to. This talk is part of a series our community has been doing on Kyra Jewel Lingo's book, We Were Made for These Times. So I suspect the majority of you have been here for talks on the preceding chapters. Is anyone here new to this book? Quick summary, I think it's great. It's a really good read. I read the first 9 chapters in 2 very engaged sittings. I found her approach very accessible and grounded. I'm reminded of our Shobo Genzo retreats in February, where we need someone with a PhD in Buddhist literature to help us interpret it. This is the opposite of that. I feel like it's just immediately accessible. You pick it up and it's just brilliant from the get-go. No interpretation needed. And I'll add, it's strikingly reminiscent of her teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, his pedagogical style. He's a legendary Zen figure from our times who recently passed, nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. His book, Miracle of Mindfulness, was really important to me early on. So it's really a delight to see her taking up that mantle and being such an incredible voice for that style of Buddhism. Today's chapter, chapter 9, is Nurturing the Good, and it focuses on gratitude. Having read it a couple of times, I wondered, should I even bother commenting on it? I thought I could just read it to you all and it'd be great. I need that nothing. I hope you get a chance to read it if you haven't. I think it's a lovely chapter. It also kind of felt like that might be my inner public speaking anxiety trying to dodge the assignment, so I, you know, as one does when they're ambivalent, I went to Michael and was like, oh, what should I do about this? And we hashed it out, and the sort of thing I left that meeting with the understanding of is I would try to speak from my practice experience about how this resonates with my life and my sense of what helps one to live well. And hopefully there would be some additional value in that. So at the very start of the chapter, Kyra has a couple of quotes, both of which I quite appreciate. The first is by Albert Camus. In the midst of winter, I finally learned that there was within me an invincible summer. And the second quote is by Toni Morrison. At some point in life, the world's beauty becomes enough. I found both of these quotes beautiful, but in different ways. That Camus quote spoke to my inner 20-year-old, this idea of an invincible summer inside, and be able to overcome any difficulty and all of that. Whereas the Toni Morrison quote, I think that's the kind of quote that I want to appreciate as a 60-year-old. To me, there's a real, what seems like wisdom from where I'm sitting, this idea of the world's beauty becoming enough. When I was younger, there was a quote, actually in a book by Albert Camus, this book, The Myth of Sisyphus, that I read when I was 18, traveling Southeast Asia, and I just visited Vietnam and Cambodia, and actually had kind of felt the last nail in the coffin of Catholicism for me. I just couldn't believe in a sort of bearded white man God up in the sky saying, "You go to hell if you ever cross me anymore." And finding this book, The Myth of Sisyphus, there was this quote at the beginning, "Oh my soul, do not aspire to immortal life, but exhaust the limits of the possible." And when I was going through this sort of gap in existential meaning and really looking for something, that quote was an anchor for me. It really gave me something to hold on to in terms of not needing an afterlife for the first time and really just committing to how can I make the most of this life. So this quote by Toni Morrison, "At some point in life, the world's beauty becomes enough." It was really lovely to encounter 20 years later. There's a passage on page 99 I'd like to read to you. "We may believe that in order to be happy, our suffering has to disappear completely, that they can't coexist. In my experience, even though I may be struggling in a time of transition or adversity, I can still be in touch with what is wholesome and good in me and around me. In fact, this is the moment I needed the most. Nurturing the good is crucial to our well-being and resilience in the face of change and tumult." In reading this quote, it really brought to mind for me a really formative time in my life where I had, I'd finished my master's degree in counseling psychology, and I had $35,000 of student loans, and I was living off my credit card trying to get a job. And they had a little wildfire in Fort McMurray, and as most of you know, I threw all my stuff into a Camry and drove up to Fort Mac and started working in the hospital there doing wildfire relief. By virtue of the role I had to take, because they can only take certain kinds of therapists, I was assigned exclusively clients who both had a significant or primary mental health condition diagnosis and a significant substance use condition. Most of these people were actively thinking about suicide. And as I worked there for 2 years, the people who were maybe not so impacted would kind of pass through my caseload, whereas the people who had 8 or 10 really grievous things all going wrong in their life stayed on my caseload. So at the end of 2 years, I was doing 2 or 3 suicide assessments and safety checks a day, where I'd be talking to someone about, how close are you today to ending your life? Can we keep you alive for a week or two? And it was in this time that trying to be present, trying to really offer whatever I had to be meaningful or helpful, that this passage by Kyra here really came to be sort of lived experience for me. I really came to see in my work how important it was, after hearing the pain that led these people to the brink, to hear from them whether there was anything in life that they still appreciated or wanted or hoped for. And similarly, you know, whether it was mental health or substance use, depression, suicide, you know, it was important to understand the risk. It was important to understand the pain. But to balance that out, if we could find some sense of purpose or what they loved in life or some kind of hope, that was really the bedrock. That was the kind of ground they could push up from. So I really think there's a lot of wisdom in this quote from Kyra on page 99. On page 100, When we nurture the wholesome seeds, the unwholesome ones shrink all by themselves, without us having to do anything directly to weaken them, because we are giving more airtime to the seeds we want to manifest. When a wholesome seed sprouts, it stimulates other beautiful wholesome seeds in our consciousness as well, making all of them stronger and more robust. Continuing with relating this to my experience as a therapist in Fort McMurray, when the work really took and causes and conditions were right, this was the best part of the work, was when less and less it was trying to minimize harm from substance use or suicide or mental health, and more it was people connecting in with what gave them a sense of purpose and a sense of life, and trusting that would lift them up so much that it meant more to sort of focus on what was lifting them up than trying to prevent what was harming them. And it was always my favorite thing to tell them, I think you're wasting your time coming to me now. I think we're at the point where you should be out with your kids, going to the beach, or returning to your work, or just having a nap, or doing something that feeds your heart. And it's been lovely knowing you, but I think you can use your time better at this point. And so here too, this idea of the nurturing the wholesome seeds, shrinking the unwholesome ones. I think at a certain point, feeding into what gives your life meaning is its own best way forward from escaping from the things that were threatening your life. Also on this page, gratitude is important when things are going well, even more important when things aren't going well. And this is a paraphrase of Joanna Macy, an environmental activist. So gratitude might not shift our mood immediately in some sort of total way. We're not going to just flip the table and be done with it. But again, that foundation of gratitude. My experience working with people who had really significant depression or really significant suicide risk, it kind of felt like being a kid under a really thick quilt and just oppressive and holding you down and stitched together with so many things. And that gratitude, it's almost like when you have that little bit of light, outside of that really big heavy quilt, you can kind of see, okay, I got a bit of fresh air, I got a bit of light, and you can kind of collect yourself and start to find your way out. And hopefully you're not all hearing this being I need that light right now and I'm that far in. Some of you might be, but I think wherever you're on this continuum, if you've stubbed your toe or if you're wondering what's the point of being alive, gratitude is a balancing factor. Gratitude is something that it creates a foundation that we can push up from and grow around. I'm now going to depart from the format here and not read one of two anecdotes from the book. I'm going to ask your forgiveness as I'm about to retell these stories. They are in the book if you want to read them. In telling my partner about this, she challenged me to ask myself why I didn't want to read them and to be open with you all about this. So I've tried to investigate that. I had to Google this word, saccharin. So something that is just really very gooey, sweet, dripping with kind of the sweetness. I find this to be a hallmark of the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. I don't know, has anyone here ever sang Kumbaya, at a scout camp or something? It's just you're all holding hands and you're waving back and forth, and it kind of feels like a big Teletubby tea party. And this story, it has that quality to me, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but when I'm honest with myself, I think I feel a bit unsafe going to a place of that tremendous sweetness. And I think it's because it hasn't been safe for me to be that sweet in my lifetime. I was bullied in high school. I had a family member who I'm not going to out, who was very intense with me as a kid. I think I was a very sensitive person growing up, and he wanted to wear that down out of me and push it out of me. And so he really tried to do his best to make me a man in the way that he thought I should be. And I remember being, you know, harassed as a tree planter, 18 years old, moving away from home. And all these situations, again and again, there have been these men who see it as a signal of contempt or invitation to predate or attack or diminish that kind of excessive sweetness. And so even if there's a part of me that does appreciate that kind of sweetness, I think this is part of the reason I'm in this Japanese tradition where we're a little more kind of cold and a little more upright and a little more kind of like taciturn or whatever, you know? And I think it's safer for me, and I think this way of being in the world feels safer to me. And so, I don't think Kyra is doing anything wrong with the story she's telling so much as it's not necessarily the medicine I'm looking for, because that kind of medicine has had side effects for me in the past, and I feel a duty to myself to learn from my experience, but what actually helps me to feel safe and alive and good to others, and what teachings support that. At the same time, recognizing that maybe these kinds of teachings are valuable to me in a way that I have my own private work to do with my therapist and partner, people who I love and trust. Not that you're not that, of course you are, but... I'm not always broadcasting all my deepest traumas to anyone on the internet, so different context. Getting back to the chapter, there's a quote here. If the only prayer you ever say in your life is thank you, it will be good enough. From Meister Eckhart. I love this quote, and I actually can't fully say why. I don't want to. I just want to let it be. It feels really sublimely self-sufficient. And I'll say it again. If the only prayer you can ever say in your life is thank you, it will be good enough. A bit further in this chapter, Kyra offers five practices that are quote-unquote scientifically proven to increase your happiness. So you can meditate or pray, you can exercise, you can be aware of three things you're grateful for, you can do a random or conscious act of kindness, or you can journal about a happy moment from the day. I want to offer to all of you, if you're interested in this kind of information, this is like the tip of the positive psychology iceberg. There's a whole domain of psychology called positive psychology. And my understanding, at least this formulation of this approach to psychology, started with Dr. Martin Seligman around 2000. And it was a reaction to psychology in the West being really focused on dysfunction and kind of reducing dysfunction. And the thinking was, instead of reducing dysfunction, why don't we hone flourishing? Why don't we actually just identify what helps us to live well and live a good life? And so there's tons of books. It's a real kind of pop phenomena right now. But the underlying mission, I think, is really great. It's trying to bring a real rigorous evidence-based approach to what allows for human flourishing. How do we live well? So I encourage you to explore that further if you have any interest. I thought about which of these five really work for me, and I meditate every day because I need it, and it's critical to my wellness. I don't exercise every day, but it would be really good for me if I did. I know that. Being aware of three things we're grateful for, it seems like a very precise number. I can't help but wonder scientifically if two or four would be too much or too little. But if I'm not just being a critical jerk, it's probably a good idea. Doing a random or conscious act of kindness. Part of my practice right now is to review my precepts every day. And I find that's like a boot up kind of, like an operating system boot up sequence for me. I meditate, I review my precepts, and then The days where I do that, I feel better about myself. And the days that I don't, I'm a bit more of a jerk. I'm just not as considerate. It's not on my mind as much. And so I've had enough experience doing that and not doing that to know I like myself better when I do than I don't. So I try to when I can. Being kind just feels better to me. And journaling about a happy moment from the day. I wish I did that more. There's a quote in this chapter, practicing mindfulness, we can practice contentment and joy in each moment, even really hard moments. My experience here is this is true more so the more I practice, but there's limits to this. And I wish there weren't, but wishing for these limits to be gone tends to just make things worse, whereas sticking with my practice and doing my best in that moment tends to lead to wellness quicker. So I think this sentiment's important. Practicing mindfulness to practice contentment and joy in each moment, even really hard moments. Perhaps the most sometimes, in the context of my life and my practice, the most I can do is to not just be fear or pain or sadness, but to bring some quality of presence or intentionality into that, knowing that that for me is the most expedient path to reconnect with these more elevated feelings of joy and contentment. As much as I'd love to abide in those places, I don't abide in those places. I come and go from those places, but I do think my mindfulness practice helps me to be there more often, and that's worthwhile. There's another quote here. The Buddha said happiness was available right in the present moment. That means right now. We can open our awareness to the conditions of happiness that already exist. You don't need to go looking for something else, present or future. And this is another quote where I hear this and I really believe that fully committing my mind and my body, whatever direction my heart calls for most deeply, moment after moment, helps to reduce my suffering and cultivate conditions that support wellness. I think even just making that effort, I feel better moment to moment compared to if I avoid that. And I have work to do on this. There's a sense for me of there's a greater depth that I could leverage this insight, and I'm a 38-year-old man. I'm still developing. I'm still trying to become a more wise person. And this is something that, as much as maybe that happiness is right here, sometimes I'm just too busy stumbling around ignoring it. So, yeah, I'm curious what it would be like to really show up for that more often and trying. Another quote later, Thai, which is the word people in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition use to refer to him affectionately, often taught that we should live our life in such a way that we create a beautiful past. That's another no comment quote. I think that really just can just sit there. I'll say it again. Thai often taught that we should live our life in such a way that we create a beautiful past. And one last quote for all of you with squirmy legs. Then we'll start to wrap this up. Even in times of hardship and transition, we can look for ways to bring joy and delight to ourselves and others in the present so that we can create a beautiful past. We can remember what we were grateful for, and even in the middle of great trouble, we can find what is not going wrong. So that's the final passage from this chapter. And personally, having engaged with this text, I really hope to try harder to weave gratitude into my life or just maintain that effort. And I really hope none of us take our lives for granted. I know this is our one chance to live, to experience, to play in love. Anything after that, I don't know. And I also know that we won't always be grateful for our lives. We will take them for granted sometimes, maybe a moment, maybe a decade. And I hope that when this happens, whenever we do notice this has happened, we can notice with a smile and return to, or perhaps even go in search of, whatever lifestyle helps us to feel most beautifully and deeply alive. And if you pay attention, I expect you'll find this tradition and the practices at its heart, or something like them, will be a vital part of that lifestyle of feeling most beautifully and deeply alive. So that is my talk for tonight. Thank you all for listening. How much time do we have? Do we have time for talking circle, or what's?
We do.
Oh, fantastic. May I ask how much time we do have to support organizing it?
8:28. So we have 15-20 minutes for discussion.
Okay. Let's try and get into groups of three. And then each person gets 5 minutes, and between getting there, doing that, and coming back out, that should be the time we have.
Sounds good. Maybe what we could do is the folks on Zoom can join us here, and we could CIG to the Sherbrooke Street Zendo folks. But maybe first, if you have some questions for us, Jacob?
I do. Thank you. So I'm going to give you three options, and whichever of these you want to speak to, it's your call. And the general practice here is to try and speak from the heart, from your own experience, when it's your turn to speak. And when it's not, just to try and let go of formulating some sort of clever, inspiring message and just try to be present for whoever is speaking. And if nothing comes up, then you can just sit in silence with each other. And then at the end of, I said 5 minutes, maybe we'll make it 4 minutes. I feel like that's a little less space to fill, short notice. We'll ring a bell in the Zendo. And if you happen to be in a Zoom group, I don't know what's gonna happen with Zoom, but we have a Zoom wizard on it. At the end of 4 minutes, just rotate to the next person. And the questions, one could be, what role has gratitude played in your life, in your wellness? What role does it play presently, could be another question. So, you know, historically, now, or what role do you think gratitude could have in your life to help you create a beautiful past? So, gratitude in the past, gratitude in the present, or possibility of gratitude in the future. Okay, we'll start to split ourselves into groups. If I leave you to do Zoom stuff, maybe I'll start to get people into groups here.
That sounds good.
Okay.
We'll say goodbye to the Sherbrooke.
Well, then I'll say Sherbrooke people.
Thank you, Sherbrooke people.
Bye.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 12.
If you're going to leave, leave now. And like Jacob said, you can self-time.
And then there's 12 of us, so we'll split into four groups of three. So I'll count you off, and then 1, 2, 3, 4 can go to corners 1, 2, 3, and 4. So 1, Susu, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, and reverse 4.
And this is the corner for one?
Yeah.
Can you remind me?
1, 2, 3-ish, and 4-ish.
Four.
And four.
Over here.
Is three here?
Yes.
And